Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, as the Ebola fear-mongering seems to be letting up a little, one thing that hasn't changed is media inattention to the xenophobia that has gone hand-in-hand with the panic. There's also been little attention to inequality and how that plays out in treatment of the deadly disease. We'll talk to medical ethicist and award-winning author Harriet Washington about Ebola. Also this week, polls show pretty clearly that the public isn't enthusiastic about getting involved in more wars. To many elites, this is dangerous isolationism and a retreat from America's rightful position as a superpower. Carl Canetta of the Project on Defense Alternatives has taken a deep look at public opinion and the problem with elite rhetoric about isolationism. He'll join us to talk about it. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The corporate media's panicky coverage of Ebola has spilled over into discussions about the state of Washington politics in general. One angle has been the fact that the United States doesn't have a Surgeon General, who presumably could be a high-profile voice of reason right now. On CBS's Face the Nation, host Bob Schieffer and Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal chalked it up to Washington being broken. Seib referred to the inability to get anything done in Congress. And on Meet the Press, one senator said the problem was Washington dysfunction. But the story is actually a lot deeper than that, and it deserves to be explained. Barack Obama's nominee, Vivek Murthy, does have a problem getting confirmed by the Senate, and the problem is called the National Rifle Association. Murthy has spoken out about gun violence as a public health issue. The NRA doesn't like that, and they let lawmakers know. Republicans have more or less uniformly come out against his nomination, and a few skittish Democrats have joined them. So that is why his nomination isn't going anywhere. A media system that actually sought to explain Washington would make this clear. As for the talk about dysfunction, maybe it's time to drop that frame altogether. Clearly, Washington is working just fine for certain interest groups.
Apparently, it's never too early for bad campaign journalism. That appears to be the lesson the Washington Post's Dan Balz was sending in the paper's October 19th edition. Poll, guess who's back on top, read the headline. And the story is about how, yes, a new poll shows that Mitt Romney is the front runner in the 2016 race for the Republican presidential nomination. The fact that Romney comes out on top, Balz writes, quote, says something about Romney, but much more about the others in the unsettled field. Close quote. Not really. Anyone who can look these things up knows that polling this early is worse than useless. In late 2006, Rudy Giuliani had the 2008 GOP nomination all wrapped up, and pundits were fantasizing about an epic Rudy-Hillary presidential contest. Balz is at least somewhat aware of this, since deeper in the article he admits that reading too much into polls right now comes with the obvious caution that these early measures are far from predictive. So why write about them, and why spend the money on doing the polls at all? Maybe because it feeds the kind of campaign coverage that corporate media are most comfortable with. Who's up, who's down, who's ahead? A poll this early on is entirely about name recognition. Most people aren't actually following the presidential campaign, so they don't know who these people are. They do remember the guy who ran last time, though, and maybe the guy whose brother was president. That doesn't sound especially newsworthy, but tell that to the Washington Post.
Speaking of the Washington Post, that paper says don't believe the new movie Kill the Messenger. The film is about San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb, who documented how CIA-linked drug traffickers supplied U.S. drug dealers with cheap cocaine, helping fuel the crack epidemic. Major media at the time did more than dismiss his findings. They ridiculed Webb and anyone who gave him credence, especially black people. The movie shows that, too, which is why the Post is so eager to tell readers that the film's depiction of a truth-teller persecuted by the cowardly and craven mainstream media is pure fiction. Instead, the October 17th piece by Assistant Managing Editor Jeff Lean only provides more evidence for that characterization. He charges that, quote, Webb's story made the extraordinary claim that the Central Intelligence Agency was responsible for the crack cocaine epidemic in America, close quote. That is false. Webb's report showed that a major California crack dealer was working with suppliers linked to the CIA-backed Contras in Nicaragua. Lean says a report from the CIA's inspector general cleared the agency. That's also untrue. The report actually confirmed the core facts of Webb's reporting. If anything, the scandal was even bigger than he noted. Lean also claims that Nick Scow, who wrote the book Kill the Messenger, agrees with him. That's also false, according to Scow, who says Lean took a statement he made out of context. He called Lean's piece a worthless and whiny op-ed that, quote, perfectly captures the craven mentality of cowardice of most of Webb's critics, close quote. Finally, Lean claims that other reporters, including him, pursued the story of CIA links to the drug trade, but didn't report it because the proof was lacking. You can guess by now how that statement holds up.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett signed a bill on October 21st banning former criminal offenders from provoking mental anguish in their victims. The legislation was aimed at Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was serving life in a Pennsylvania prison for the 1981 murder of a Philadelphia police officer. Abu-Jamal has become a cause célèbre, with many supporters claiming his original trial was grossly unfair. Mumia, who was a radio personality before going to prison, has remained in the public eye through taped commentaries and phone interviews. The legislation was prompted when students at Goddard College in Vermont played a special pre-recorded Abu-Jamal commencement address at the college's graduation ceremonies. Angered by this, Pennsylvania lawmakers cooked up the blatantly unconstitutional Re-Victimization Relief Act, which Governor Corbett signed. Despite its shocking implications for free expression, banning speech that causes mental anguish could include almost any political speech, but for all that, the bill has gotten very little media attention, and some of the coverage has been unhelpful. The headline over an AP dispatch in the October 22nd New York Times was, "Pennsylvania, Governor signs law to help protect crime victims." Media outlets that rely on the First Amendment, which would be all of them, should be confronting the Pennsylvania government's efforts to silence speech instead of ignoring it.
And finally, sometimes you can tell a lot about where media are coming from by the offhand language that is used to describe certain things. The New York Times reported on Venezuela securing a seat on the UN Security Council. In the news section, it said that the country, quote, may well use its perch on the council for delivering anti-American diatribes, close quote. No, not criticizing U.S. foreign policy, delivering diatribes. That's the kind of language one might expect from an overheated editorial. Another piece in the Times made reference to former D.C. schools chancellor Michelle Rhee, a highly controversial figure in the national debate over corporate education reform. The Times explained that Rhee was someone who, quote, drew hostility from teachers with her efforts to lift performance in the district, close quote. Well, no, that's not really it. Teachers didn't object to Rhee wanting to make schools better. They objected to her brusque management style, her over-reliance on standardized test scores, and her determination to fire teachers and close schools, and her championing of charter schools, and on and on. These examples are just a reminder that sometimes, in just a few words, you can tell a lot about how corporate media see the world.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. The volume of media coverage of Ebola stands in contrast to the amount of useful analysis and information we are getting about the infectious disease. After a very bad start with much fear-mongering and hype, some media outlets are catching up and explaining the actual threat Ebola poses. What is mostly still missing, however, is how Ebola, like many infectious diseases before it, exacerbates xenophobia and affects the poor and communities of color disproportionately. Joining us to talk about this is medical ethicist and writer Harriet Washington. Washington is the author of, among other things, Medical Apartheid, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Welcome to Counterspin, Harriet Washington.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, the story of how racism and xenophobia play into disease panics is not a new one. Do you think it's playing out with the Ebola story?
Oh, absolutely. And as you point out, it's far from new. In fact, I would submit that we have experienced these fears of the other, fears of people who are racially different or economically different, strangers, in effect, and conflated them with disease ever since the germ theory first associated microbes and illness. And there are many reasons for that, but it's an ancient history. We do it over and over again, not, of course, just with African Americans. I mean, there's a long history of the Chinese being blamed for plagues in San Francisco in 1900 and typhoid Mary, her real name is Mary Mallon, being blamed for, you know, spreading typhoid, largely because she was Irish, and the Irish were a despised minority group during that time. Jews in the Polish ghettos were blamed for disease, which was actually manufactured by their oppressors. But on American soil, it's Black people who we expressly fear. And when infection strikes and when it's associated with Black people, all the stops get pulled out, and we use it as an excuse to exercise all our xenophobic and racist trends and fears. And it's a phenomenon that lately evolutionary biologists have actually labeled protective prejudice. You know, their theory is that our behavioral immune system, analogous to our physiological immune system, causes us to avoid or to actually attack people who we suspect might be carrying microbes. But the problem is, of course, that we can't do this very accurately. Unlike, say, Caribbean spiny lobsters who can smell infected lobsters, we're not equipped to look at someone and determine whether they're infected. So all these factors, social, political, and even psychological and biological, play into this xenophobia that has been triggered by the Ebola crisis.
Well, I recall Lou Dobbs, a broadcaster on CNN and then Fox, suggesting that immigrants coming across the Mexican border were disease carriers. Is that the same sort of thing? And is this disease panic being put to the service of other agendas?
Oh, certainly it is. It's been kidnapped, you know, or conscripted in order to play into all kinds of agendas, closing the border, for example. The other thing I think is really interesting here, although I have to admit I don't have any hard data on it, a lot of us, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's a fan of horror movies. You know, all these movies about infection, 28 days later, outbreak. We devour these movies. We love these films. And I see some bleeding over from fantasy and reality here. You know, very often even the news accounts will present scenarios in West Africa, and one would, you know, swear one was reading a movie script. Our problem is the script is not accurate. It reflects more our fears and our ideas about how things should progress than what is actually progressing.
You were on the public radio show The Takeaway recently discussing some of these issues, but we've seen very little discussion of xenophobia or racism. What have you noticed as far as media discussion of xenophobia and the Ebola story?
Yes, there is relatively little coverage. What there is coverage, though, is I recall not too long ago we were reading a great deal about the supposed fear of medicine that was hampering medical care for people. I mean, what we kept reading was that we go into these areas and we try to help people, but they won't cooperate with us. They run from us. They're afraid of getting medical care. I'm highly doubtful of that. You know, the problem is that you're helicoptering in. You know nothing about these people and the culture, haven't particularly tried to find out. And if they're exhibiting aversive behavior, you haven't tried to find out why. You know, you're describing it as avoiding medical care, but perhaps they are avoiding you for other reasons. Behavior is just presented with your interpretation of it, and we're supposed to accept that. By discounting the rational reasons, you are presenting people on one side of the equation, and that is the Western side of the equation, as being rational, and people on the other side as being irrational.
Well, you know, one of the other things that we haven't seen very much of is the addressing of poverty and inequality as it relates to medicine and the Ebola story. There's a lot of intersectionality here between poverty and xenophobia and racism. One of the manifestations of this inequality is seen in the reluctance of Western pharmaceutical companies to fully develop a vaccine for the virus until it looked like Western populations were threatened.
Well, that would be a very short-sighted policy because then it would be too late. I pointed out in late August that I saw that there was reluctance to distribute ZMapp to Africans. I also saw a reluctance to discuss work on a vaccine. People kept stressing how much it would cost, how expensive it would be. And I pointed out that if Ebola should make landfall in America, in the Americas, and in Europe, we're going to need that vaccine. You know, if this is a case in which the right thing is done for the wrong reason, then that would be good insofar as Africans would get the medication they need. So my hope is that actually that there will be a perception that we have a common need here and Mbale will be perfected, that will work against Ebola. Even if it's only done because there's concern about treating Europeans and Westerners. But the problem, in my view, will emerge if there is not a modality perfected or if when it is not distributed to Africans. That's the thing that would be absolutely unacceptable. It's unacceptable for obvious ethical reasons, but it's also unacceptable for economic justice because our countries, the developed world, makes a great deal of money by testing medications cheaply in the developing world. And although we keep portraying Africans as supplicants, you know, they're asking for our help, they're begging for medication, in my opinion, the reality is exactly the opposite. We owe them. It's only because of their sacrifice that we've made a lot of money and had medications we need. If this is a chance to repay the favor, we should be eager to do so.
Harriet Washington, you have written whole books on medical ethics and how certain communities are often left out when it comes to health care and medical advances. Why do you think these issues, poverty and xenophobia, are not covered better than they are by mainstream corporate media?
Well, to actually know why, you'd have to ask them, but I can tell you my opinion. My opinion is that to do so would cast the medical system to which we have so much invested, it would cast it in a very poor light indeed. I pointed out in Deadly Monopolies how great the divergence is between people's medical needs and what pharmaceutical companies profit by. And if there were a greater understanding of that and how it applies in cases such as the Ebola vaccine, it would cast the industry in a very poor light. And in my opinion, some people find it a lot more convenient and easy not to even examine that aspect. It's a classic case of blame the victim. It's a little easier to castigate the people who are falling victim to the disease as irrationally refusing medical help or being somehow aggressive or inappropriate or, you know, threatening our borders, and it is to perhaps look at our failures in terms of what we should have been doing and what we should be doing now to help.
We've been speaking with Harriet Washington, medical ethicist and author of 2007's Medical Apartheid. Thanks again for joining us on Counterspin today, Harriet Washington.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In late August, the front page of USA Today sported the headline, "More Want U.S. to Flex Muscle." This was based on a new poll which found that more Americans wanted the country to help solve problems around the world. The newspaper's assumption was that problem-solving meant making war. Misconceptions about how Americans view the world and the U.S. role in it are pretty common. Some of those mistaken ideas are discussed in a new paper from the Project on Defense Alternatives. It's called Something in the Air: Isolationism, Defense Spending, and the U.S. Public Mood. We're joined now by the author. He's the group's director, Carl Canetta. Carl, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, the first point seems to be that a lot of people, pundits, lawmakers, and so forth, conflate some of these issues. They talk about the threat of a new isolationism in the U.S. public. Americans want to withdraw from the world. They keep wanting to get out of military conflicts, so on and so forth. You say it's a pretty narrow read of the public opinion data on these questions. Explain what this rhetoric about isolationism gets wrong about how the public really feels.
You know, the discussion of this always seems to circle around questions of military intervention. The talk of isolationism began shortly after the official withdrawal of the United States from Iraq. It pertained to involvement in Libya, involvement in Syria, involvement in Ukraine. And for a long time, polls showed real dissent from the prospect of getting involved in new conflicts abroad. And it's based on that, based on people's reaction to the prospect of war, of new wars, that many pundits began talking about an isolationist trend. It's not isolationist. It was anti-interventionist in the context of 12 years, 13 years of experience of wars that did not go very well, the anticipated result of our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, did not indicate that this was a productive approach to resolving conflict. And that's where the American public is coming from.
You had one line in there where you talked about, you know, the familiar trope is that the public is war weary, and a better way of thinking about it is war wise. One of the fascinating things, I think, was how the paper talks about how elites view these questions versus the U.S. public. They see a kind of primacy that the United States must not just be involved in the world, it must dominate the world. You know, when you talk about the problems with the public discussion that we have, if elites have this fundamentally different worldview of what the United States should be doing in the world, it kind of stands to reason that our discussion of what the United States should be doing in the world is going to be rather one-sided in a way.
Well, that's right. What we've had in successive administrations in the post-Cold War period, we saw it in the end of the first Bush administration, the Clinton administration, subsequent Bush administration, and now as well, unfortunately, in the Obama administration. It's a view of the United States as having a predominant military power and trying to think about how to use that to actually transform the world. So it's looking at the military as a transformative instrument, as opposed to a defensive instrument, which was the view that prevailed during the Cold War. And it's that step that the public is skeptical about. I don't think that we can say that the public is inherently skeptical about it, but they learn from experience over time. So taking a look at the ways that we have led in the post-Cold War world with an emphasis on military power, military intervention, using our military to presumably shape the policy of other nations like China and Russia, this the public has real questions about when they see that the payout of this vastly expensive approach does not meet expectations. And in fact, we find ourselves involved in quagmires, or we find ourselves contributing to instability. We see Americans being put into harm's way without any discernible improvement in security or stability. So the public learns over time. And it's also important, the change in the economic circumstances. This increases people's sensitivity to the cost-benefit balance. When folks are having a hard time meeting their mortgage payments, when they see their economic position slipping, they become more sensitive to these types of questions. They want to see positive outputs from government, and that pertains in the military realm as well as the domestic.
And one of the lessons from the paper was that the U.S. public does have a view of the U.S. role in the world and being involved in the world, but they can see it in very different ways. It doesn't always have to be the military.
No, that's right.
There's certainly other ways you express your involvement in the world, which I think is one of the disconnects between how elites see the world and how the rest of us do.
There's enduring support for diplomatic initiatives, for cooperation with other nations, for cooperation with the United Nations. People want to see the United States involved in the world. They tend to prefer a diplomatic over a military approach. People are willing to go to war for a variety of reasons, but what always pertains in these circumstances is that they want to see discrete ends, pragmatic ends. Sort of, they need to feel that the goals are realistic, and in the end, they need to see a result. But we can't have the impression that this is an immediate reflex. It takes time for the public to assess how a campaign abroad is going. So there was a period at the beginning of the Iraq War where you began to see people having doubts about defense spending, but not yet moving into opposition. And then around 2005, 2006, the opposition component began to grow, and it became predominant after 2007, 2008. The public wants a strong military. It doesn't want to see that military misused abroad. And when it seems as though it is, support for spending declines. A curious thing is that the public doesn't see defense spending as necessarily connected to military activism or intervention abroad. Sometimes they can view a strong defense and a big defense budget as a kind of alternative to intervention. If we're strong militarily, people will leave us alone. And that's the type of thing.
Finally, you mentioned this earlier, and it is kind of the pertinent question right now. There was this sense of relief almost when you saw public opinion swing pretty dramatically in favor of military action against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Some of the elites who were warning about isolationism were heartened. You know, Americans are finally going to lead here and flex muscle and what have you. Is there any sense that this is a lasting shift in public sentiment on these questions?
No, I think that what we have is an enduring dissent from the overuse of military power, that there can be a blip to support a particular incident tied to a rather vicious and public attack on Americans. The public will move to respond to that. I think what the lasting effect is the skepticism about the use of force. And it calls to mind the post-Vietnam period. There was, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, strong support for increasing defense spending. As soon as President Reagan began to have a bellicose view of the U.S. in the world, that support faded. And within 2 years, the public swung back into support for reducing defense spending.
We've been speaking with Carl Canetta. He's director of the Project on Defense Alternatives at the Center for International Policy. You can go to FAIR's website and you'll find a link to their new report, which is called Something in the Air, Isolationism, Defense Spending, and the U.S. Public Mood. Carl Canetta, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, FAIR's magazine. Go to FAIR.org to find out how to subscribe. That's also where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the Counterspin podcast, or watch FAIR TV. This show is engineered by Alex Noyes and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.